my countrymen.
Just bows up and strides
out. Brendan Fletcher is the writer and director of the feature film Mad Bastards. The movie tells the story of TJ, an ex-con with a fiery temper, making his way north from Perth to the Kimberley region of northwestern Australia.
What's the matter, my boy? You got trouble anyway?
I wouldn't know where to start.
TJ, why do you want to go all the way up there?
Honey, I know what I've got to do and I'm doing it.
You look, you're not from this country.
It's my son's country.
TJ is on a pilgrimage to see the town of Five Rivers, where he hopes to connect with his 13-year-old son, Bullet, whom he has never met. Along the way, TJ meets a host of characters, including the Pigram family, who are well-known musicians from Broome. Meanwhile, at Five Rivers, Bullet's mum is struggling with alcohol, and Bullet himself is in trouble with the police. Grandpa Tex, the local copper, wants to change things for his family and for the men of the town as he sees so much dysfunction, violence, and abuse. It's an odyssey of self-discovery and the difficult journey towards manhood that, in a sense, TJ and Bullet have to make at the same time.
Any of you boys want to talk about something that you want to get off your chest?
Hello, hello, my countrymen.
Just bows up and strides herself.
Hey, look at them mad bastards.
The rain comes down.
Anyone? Fair enough. Maybe a bit too soon, eh?
The narrative is born out of oral stories from the people in the Kimberley, so it has a really authentic and honest feel. It's a rewarding experience for the moviegoer. Brendan Fletcher came into CPX to talk about his film. Brendan, thanks so much for coming in and congratulations on the film.
Thanks, Simon.
Fantastic film. I get the impression this is a very personal story for you. How did you come to be involved with it?
I'd been making documentary films in the Kimberley since about 1997. And I just had come across so many people that I thought were, you know, larger than life characters that had amazing life stories. And I thought to myself, well, there hasn't really been a film about the Kimberley, about this part of the world. You sort of, we've had films, you know, from the Territory and from other kind of frontiers. I suppose I just saw the opportunity for that there, and combined with that, the fact that there was so much natural talent. You know, I met these guys who I just thought were movie stars that needed a movie,
waiting
you know?
To come out. Right,
yeah,
right.
They needed a story that was that they could sort of just get their teeth into. So.
And you've obviously had a lot of involvement with the community there and mixed in with the people.
Oh, there's no other way to do it, you know. Basically, making the docos over those years, I met a lot of people right across the Kimberley. And the bonds that we'd kind of formed and the places they took me and the stories they told me were just so amazing. And you know, over a long period, those relationships formed, and we, you know, you could sort of say that we built the film on top of those relationships. You know, it wasn't like I kind of went in there and went, "Oh, I've got this great idea for a movie about this guy, and he's got a son, he's got to go find him." It was nothing like that at all. You know, usually you write your script and then you cast it and so forth. But we sort of did it back to front. You know, we actually found the people and then built the film around what worked for them as performers and, you know, as storytellers.
And it emerges out of stories that you've heard these people tell, right?
I wanted them to be in the film right from the word go. In fact, with our first script development grant, we started shooting because I thought, well, if this doesn't work, if these guys aren't natural performers like I think they are, then I'm not even gonna write the first draft of a script. So right from the word go, we had that concept of using the real people to play characters that are kind of very similar to who they are. And it just sort of evolved from there, you know, and then they would tell me stories about their lives and it wasn't sort of formal, it wasn't sort of, you know, with a whiteboard and, you know, it was very organic. It was over fishing trips and camping trips and time at the pub, or, you know, I remember many nights, you know, drinking tea till late into the, you know, into early hours of the morning at times. I remember one morning, you know, kind of seeing the sunrise with a cup of tea in my hand, and me and this other guy had been talking the whole night about his life, you know. So that went on for a long time, and there was a big collection of notepads and oral stories recorded, and then it was just sifting through it.
What's the best part of casting these people who mostly aren't actors, are they? And the most challenging part?
The best part is, I think they give a unique screen presence. You know, they have something about them. You know, I realised pretty early on that if we could stop them acting, then we'd have something, you know, because when they could just be, they were naturally captivating, naturally compelling. So I think the end result of that is that you have something that's really quite unusual, because there's not a kind of posture of acting, there's not a delivery of acted dialogue, you know. They're using their words. A lot of the time it's improvised dialogue. So I think that's certainly the best thing, is it's something that's kind of quite, has a certain feeling that's
real. Something authentic, isn't it?
Yeah, it's definitely kind of something authentic. But the most challenging part was when we had things that absolutely needed to happen for the story, and they had to say a certain line of dialogue or whatever, matching the tone of that, which was basically acting, you know, was acted scenes versus the more improvised ones. Getting those two things to merge was tricky.
That's a challenge.
But, you know, the funny thing was, as the shoot went on, the kind of our non-actors became actors. Like, they kind of started to get the whole rhythm of a film set and the process and the structure and the schedule, and you know, they started out non-actors, but they finished up actors, you know.
Maybe there's hope for me yet. Yeah, there's plenty, obviously, Theo. I think we could do it sometime.
It's never too late, Simon.
I think it might be in my case. Now, you tell the stories of these Aboriginal communities in quite a confronting way. You don't shrink back from that. Mm. And some of it's pretty disturbing. Mm. What were you hoping to achieve in telling the story that way?
In those years of talking to people when we were sort of developing the idea, you know, I always would sit down and yarn with people, and I'd say to them at the end of the thing about their life stories, I'd say, well, if you were the director of the film, if you had all the control, what would you put in the film? How would you tell it? What would you want to see up there on the screen? And this one girl said to me, you know what, just tell it like it is, Bryn. Just serve it up in a full 5-course meal and just tell it exactly how it is, and don't be afraid of that, and we'll back you, you know? And I just never forgot that, because I thought the last thing I want to do, you know, is go to all this trouble and raise all this money and spend all these years and do something that kind of wasn't great, if you know what I mean. I mean, not that I know that the film's great, but it wasn't worth it, you know. And we might only get one shot at this, and if we do it well, then other people will get a shot at doing that as well. So I suppose I just didn't want to make something that mucked around, you know. The idea was to do it, tell it truthfully and tell it honestly, and you know, in doing that, I think that we as a community can start to own up to some of the responsibilities that we have, you know, whether you're someone that lives in that community, whether you're an Australian citizen, you know, you can sort of see that on the screen, and there's no prettying up of it.
Well, there's a kind of a brutal, hard-edged element to the story. But within that, there's great beauty as well. There's a tenderness to it. Is that your experience of life in the Kimberley?
Hugely. What I didn't want to do was make a film that was one of those kind of bleak, depressing, kind of responsible films where you sort of feel like you've done a duty by seeing this film, and, you know, you feel guilty or something, you know, because that wasn't my experience of the world, you know. I met these characters, particularly these men, you know, who had turned their life around, you know, who had changed the way that they lived their life in a remarkable way, and that was hugely inspiring to me. And I thought, well, you just never hear the good stuff, you know. You hear the intervention and the violence and the drugs and the alcohol. But how often do you hear a story about a man who's kind of turned his life around for the sake of his family and his community, you know? So it was very important to me that although we went there and that we showed, the, as you said, the kind of brutality of some of that life and showed that honestly, that we actually passed through that as well, and that the film was a film that was kind of about hope and redemption.
There's definite elements of the story, although it's not preachy, but there's sort of messages that you could get. One seemed to be that people have a choice in how they deal with real hardship in their life.
Yeah.
Is that part of what you're on about?
The main characters in the film are TJ and Texas, the two men, you know, and then the third one, I suppose, is his son.
Bullet.
And the men that played those roles of TJ and Texas had made choices in their lives, you know, and they could almost tell you the hour of their life that they made that choice, you know, that changed their life. So, and the first step to many of those choices is actually just owning up to, you know, a responsibility that you have, you know, to your family or your kids or, you know, your community, and or an issue that you're battling with, you know. So I suppose I'd seen that in real life, and the guys playing these roles had experienced that in real life, so it was always going to be a strong part of the film.
Even as you do make those good choices, you need support. You need a community around you. There was a lovely scene, a couple of them, with the men's group that are trying to start up, which was varying success, but you get a sense that it's going to get better along the way.
Well, you know, that's a classic example of the movie. I mean, Greg Tate plays the character of Texas, who's the cop, you know, and Greg Tate is a cop. You know, he's been the Halls Creek policeman for 17 years, you know, senior sergeant there. And he started up a men's group on his balcony. You know, the government wouldn't give him funding because, you know, he wasn't an established charity or whatever it was. And no one came, and then he had to buy the sausages and tomato sauce to get them to come. And then they'd come and they'd, you know, eat all the food, but they wouldn't talk. And, you know, so that scene has a lineage in Greg's life, like 100%. You know, that's just a huge part of his life. What you said is a really lovely way to put it, that you need to support change. And I suppose that's what I felt, is that there's not much that I can do as one person in Sydney about what's happening in our Indigenous communities out there, but you can support people who are trying to make changes. And, you know, I think that's, fingers crossed, that's kind of what we're starting to see.
Now, fathers and father figures are crucial in the development of young people, aren't they? And you really see this in this film. That's not limited to Aboriginal communities, though. But is that a key aspect of healthy community?
I think definitely. I was struck by the father figures that I encountered as me going up there, you know, and I think that was part of what drove me to make this film in the first place, was that encountering a real man. It wasn't like a superhero or a, you know, a kind of a, when I say a real man, it wasn't a tough guy. It was someone that can be tough when you need to be tough, but can be really tender, you know. And the amount of times that I'd be hearing these guys sort of, you know, talk about being in fights or defending themselves or, you know, kind of getting angry about things that they should be angry about. And then the next moment they'd be crying about their grandma, you know, or their daughter, you know. And it sort of, I suppose it's sort of what affected me so profoundly was this sense of being able to be strong as a man, as the sort of archetypal man, male character is, but also having the strength to be vulnerable and to express tenderness as a male. And that's something that, you know, you sort of don't see a lot of in cinema, you know. I mean, I suppose you do more and more, but in terms of what makes a man, you don't often see that. And I think that's, you know, a great story. Actually, Greg Tate, who plays Texas, said to me one day when we were sort of working on the story, because, you know, we should have, I'm not, you know, I reckon it'd be good if we got people to cry in this film, you know, if we had a couple of scenes that really made the audience like tear up, you know. And he said, I reckon these men, all these tough guys in the film should be, you know, they should be like, he was trying to think of the word, they should be, have that thing, you know, that, you know, what's that thing that women do? That, you know, vulnerable, that's it, vulnerable, you know. And he literally couldn't find the words for it. But
he
knew what it meant, and he knew how important it was, you know. And that's, you know, almost the theme of the film, is that these men can't find the words for it, but they know the importance of the place in their lives.
Now, the music is a key part of the story. It's really evocative and somehow seems to fit the landscape. How do those two things come together?
Because the Pigram brothers were my entry into that world and that land.
This is the musical group, right?
Exactly. They're the guys that actually play that music. And I'd started by making music videos with them. And they actually are the producers of the film with me. So there was always going to be a strong musical component. But I didn't want it to be sort of soundtrack. I didn't want it to be just stuff that's in the background or playing in a radio in the kitchen. You know, I kind of wanted the music to be in the film because there's just something really special about the quality of the Pigram sound. The way they, you know, they had these sort of ukuleles and mandolins, and their sort of vocal quality is, it's quite magical, and it really kind of transports you to the Kimberley, because I suppose their sound is the sound of the place, you know. And you know, I like movies where you walk in and you sort of feel like you're taken to another world. You're sort of removed from your everyday life, and you're taken somewhere that you wouldn't normally get to experience. And music is such a big part of being able to do that. And then teaming up the Pigram Brothers with Alex Lloyd was just, you know, it was kind of a radical idea, but it worked out really well. He's just such a great songwriter and he's got such a fantastic voice, but kind of melding that sound with his kind of strength with the Pigram Brothers sound was just, you know, really.
Yeah, so he plays a character in the film, right? A mechanic, yeah. Who plays with them.
Yeah. And so on. Yeah. Well, we kind of like that idea of the Greek chorus that just kind of pops up every now and then and sort of sings a song, and it's a bit of a non sequitur, but it gives you a bit of a moment, you know, out of the drama, where it sort of balances some of the harshness of the film, where the music, I mean, the music is almost like a healing, I think, in the film, you know, and the songs are a little bit like lullabies, you know, and they sort of balance out some of the kind of more harder aspects of the film.
There's a need for some healing after some of those scenes.
Yeah. Well, it's always, you know, it's about balance, and there's so much warmth and so much humanity in the music. I think that sort of, you know, it just really makes the film a rich experience.
It seemed to me there were some spiritual, perhaps religious, elements to the film. The key character, TJ, underwent what I thought looked a bit like a baptism, you know, a washing of his sins and failures that I think he felt like he needed. Does that resonate at all with you?
Totally. I mean, everyone who sees the film will see some of these scenes in their own way. I mean, what was actually happening there was, I guess, a kind of a welcome to country from an Aboriginal perspective, where he was, you know, it did look exactly like a baptism, you know, he was being kind of rinsed and cleansed, I suppose. And the symbolism of that resonates with people of all kind of walks of life. And what you read into that is what you read into it. But it's almost impossible to read into anything, read it any other way as some kind of cleansing and some kind of like break from the past and welcoming into a new community, you know? So we were just absolutely always going to make, you know, a film that had a spiritual kind of richness to it and a spiritual dimension to it. But we didn't want to over-explain it either. We didn't want to sort of preach it, and we didn't want to sort of, you know, I suppose sometimes when you literalize things, you kind of destroy them, or you sort of destroy their power. And there's something, you know, something wonderful about the mystery, you know, about just letting it be there kind of letting it work its magic on you as a human being.
There's a power in the way it's expressed without saying too much in it. Yeah. Also, themes like the need for forgiveness and mercy, grace. Yeah. It's all needed in there, isn't there? And, and there's sort of almost non-material aspects to that.
Yeah, and there's just, you know, non-material aspects to the whole film. I think that's why people are responding to it so well, because, you know, there's actually not a lot of dialogue in the film, and the story is as old as the hills. It's a story about a father and a son reconnecting, you know. It's not a kind of radical new story, but the place in which it's set and I suppose the elements that are around that story make it a very rich experience. And there's some things that aren't set in dialogue, and that's a lovely word to use, grace, you know, because I think the character of Texas, who challenges TJ when he first comes back to see his son and ultimately kind of welcomes him, he displays a you know, a great deal of grace, you know, towards him. And for a really big, tough guy that would give Tamura Morrison from Once Were Warriors a bit of a run for his money, that's an unexpected word to use, grace, you know. But I suppose that's why the film carries a sense of truth, because life is layers of contradictions, and you know, I think we all embody that in one way or the other. Look at a character like Uncle Black, who's the kind of wandering cowboy that was always bumming a smoke from TJ, you know. And he's, you know, he's had a tough life, but he's got so much love and kind of acceptance for TJ right from when he first meets him, you know. So I just felt like there was a lovely spirit about these characters that often words would literalise that spirit, and that somehow diminishes it, you know. Whereas if you could just allow it to be evocative, and there's just enough story to keep you kind of there from a narrative point of view, but we took away everything that you really didn't need, that we felt was expressed by the physicality of the characters, you know.
It felt a bit like a Tim Winton novel to me, in that it's pretty...
That's a compliment.
Oh, it is definitely from me. I'm a big fan of Tim Winton's work. But in the sense that there's redemption there, but you have to look for it.
Mm.
And there's an optimism too as well, although, you know, on the bare face of it, it might not be immediately obvious.
I don't know. When you go on a journey with a character that goes into tough places and then comes out of that at the end, I think all human beings can identify with that. And they are appreciative of being told the truth and being shown something in a way that's realistic, but also coming out, and it's like they've fought those fights with that character as well. And when they've kind of come out, you know, with a sense of hope and sort of forgiveness and redemption, it just seems to kind of manifest itself in you in the cinema. So we're really happy about all that.
This experience made you want to make more films, or are you exhausted by it and had it?
Both. You know, I definitely want to make more films, but it was, I think, because of all the things we've been talking about, it was really hard to make. You know, it's tough to be truthful, you know, and it's tough to elicit truthful performances and tell a truthful story and kind of balance, you know, your ambition of kind of a truthful, soulful film with kind of the commercial constraints of making movies and funding bodies and all that kind of stuff. So a lot going on for a long time behind the scenes to kind of give birth to this film. But, you know, after swearing I'd never do it again, now I'm sort of going, oh, so when's the next one going to come? What am I going to do now, you know?
Well, you definitely came up with a truthful, soulful film, and congratulations on it. Thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thanks, Simon.